So today I wanted to talk about basic core of this practice. Of course, every day I have been discussing that, but I feel like I haven't been clear. It hasn't been good enough. I also wanted to discuss the forms, the rituals, which have a direct link with the basic core of the practice. So I took off my robe to discuss the forms and the core of the practice. Which, in a sense, would be enough. If I were really direct, I would just take off my robe and I would not have to say anything. But I'm not that good. I'm not that direct. So I have to say something. So the basic core of the practice, the essence of what was first at the beginning, before this was called Buddhism, because it didn't become Buddhism. In fact, now what I teach, I don't usually say it's Buddhism, but I have to admit that it is part of a Buddhist school. At the beginning, before it was called Buddhism, what the person who started this whole thing, in a sense, realized was what we say is the illusion of self, right? This is a phrase that we use. Think of it like a shadow. Or mirage. Do you say mirage in Portuguese? It's the result of a certain number of circumstances. And it appears very real. And it appears solid and so clear. When you see that mirage on the horizon, it's there. You see your shadow. It's there. Apparently, even colors are like this, that colors don't really exist, that they result from a combination of light and the very technical functioning of our eye, the way that the light is thrown onto the retina, that makes colors appear, that they don't actually exist, but they look very real to us, colors. When we talk about the self in this context, it's of that nature. It's the result of innumerable phenomena. Circumstances. And we take that to be real. like we say that this is red. Within the illusion, it is red. That's true. And it's a different color of red than the red of Antonio's jacket. And it's different than black. That's true. Within the framework of this illusion, that's true. There are those very clear distinctions. But to ignore the fact that the shadow is not really there, the mirage is not really there, that this is not really red, is to miss the other aspect of it. It's to be blind, to not see, to be asleep, we say. So often we say the point of this practice is to let go of the self, to abandon the self. It takes on, it becomes very elaborate. People say that you have to leave your possessions, leave your life, shave your head, wear a certain piece of clothing in order to abandon the self. It's not so much an abandonment as it is, or letting go, as it is seeing through, to see the reality of it. And in that sense, the only thing that needs to be let go of is the illusion. So what follows from that, from not letting go of that, from not seeing through that, are a certain number of consequences. And what follows from seeing through that is there are certain other consequences. I said we don't need to wear a certain piece of clothing, we don't need to shave our head, we don't need to live in a certain way. As I said yesterday, we don't need the flowers, the incense, the candle. In this notion of self and of, we could say, not self, there are many different comparable dualities. So we can say the self, what we think of as the solid self, is the personal, and the non-self is the impersonal. Does that exist in Portuguese? Impersonal and personal? We can say it is separate and not separate. We can say it's diverse and unified. We can say it's relative and absolute. We can say it's form and non-form or emptiness. We can say it's permanent and impermanent, born, unborn, dying, undying. All of these dualities that we use for these two aspects. One that I particularly like is discontinuous and continuous. Because this one little limited personal self that we think of as being solid form feels separate, discontinuous, it feels cut off. Whereas the other aspect of being is continuous, unified, whole, not fragmented. Without limits. So, how does this, what does this mean for the practice? And what do all of the rituals and the forms that I said I wanted to talk about have to do with that? We each come here as individuals, and we, as I said, look very different. We have different lives. We manifest wildly the world of diversity. And we come together here and become parts of a whole by sitting here together. Now, this is true of it's so elegant, this. It's true of each individual. We are a whole individual made up of very different parts. And each part is whole and made up of very different parts. Each cell is a whole made up of different parts, and it's impossible to follow it to the end. There is no end. The same is true of each of these individual whole parts made up of individual parts that comes to join the other individual parts in this whole. And each of us includes everything and brings that, our individual inclusiveness, to the group as a part in the group. We don't necessarily experience this, however. We are mainly experiencing our separation and our difference. The more we sit, as the days go on, and we participate together in these activities that we do, the more we open to the feeling of one. And we have less of an attachment to our sense of separateness. Although that's still present. We're still different, but we have more access to the other aspect. All of the forms and the rituals and the structure have that intention. It's through the ritual that the individual, the personal, the separate, the discontinuous, can experience the continuous, the one, the impersonal, the limitless, because one of the fundamental aspects of this personal, of this separation, of this form, is the thinking mind. The intellect, coherence, organization, separation, distinction, knowledge. And through the ritual, the ritual belongs to the world, to the aspect of incoherence, not knowing, not organization, not a meaning in the sense that the thinking mind can find a meaning. It uses aspects of the concrete, personal world of form. It uses, the ritual uses those aspects in a way that is incoherent to the usual functioning mind. Because of that, we gain an experience of oneness and of this continuous being that is, we think of as being beyond. In fact, it's not beyond. It's beyond in the sense it's unknowable according to the mind that knows, usually. I brought my notes because there were things I didn't want to forget, which I usually don't do. So an example of this, rational self that thinks of itself as being something coherent and solid and individual, through a ritual such as bowing, for example, which seems to be, it can take on a big significance. We can resist it, we can be uncomfortable with it, we can think it's not appropriate. We can also do it without thinking. We can also think, oh, I like this, or I don't know, whatever, however we approach it. It is the basic premise of bowing is to take us from our personal small, isolated, rational self to an experience of impersonal, irrational, unlimited self. The other aspect. And it does this through, again, using this form to which we are very attached and to which we have attached a lot of ideas, and among those ideas is that it has a certain status, it has a certain place, it has certain characteristics that are threatened by other characteristics and other activities, and it seeks to keep those characteristics out. It's very personal. When we bow, I said we have access to this other experience, because if we really bow, we are putting down, like saying, instead of holding this, I'm setting it down. I'm setting down all of these characteristics, beliefs, everything that makes this individual shut off, limitless, limited, personal, not, this is not necessarily negative, what I'm saying. It's not that these are bad. I'm not saying it puts down everything bad that I'm doing. That's not it. This act of bowing is simply a tool, if you will, through which we can experience the other aspect. It helps us to put aside what we usually think of as ourself and therefore experience the other aspect of ourself. So I use bowing as one example, but following the schedule is another. We put aside our opinions, our what we think we should do at 11:30, and we just do it. We just come because the schedule says to do this. We put aside a part of the personal, and we accept to do something impersonal. The same with eating in a ritual way. We put aside our little habits of how we eat and what we eat and when we eat and how we eat with other people, how we eat alone, and in that way we gain an experience of this other aspect. Sitting, same thing. Walking, the walking meditation. We put aside our usual way of walking and where our personal I would like to go at that moment, and we just follow. We join the flow of all of these not selves, or all of these selves that have joined the flow of not self. Now, often what we then we say, okay, I understand this, and okay, and then we start attaching to the forms. Maybe not here, because, or maybe, I don't know. Probably, yes, probably in some ways we are attaching to the forms here. Even though to me it seems like they are very minimal, but probably we are attaching to them and having reactions according to that attachment. Either we don't want to do it and we find ways not to do it, or we really like it and we're attached to it and at the end we won't want to stop it, or many different possibilities in between. And we even probably have ideas about how it should be done now and how it shouldn't be. At this time we should be doing that. And if it's a little late or a little early, it's not right. Or the tea should be served this way. Or the bowls should be put here. And if they're not, then we're not happy. Or we might have the opposite reaction of, they want me to serve the tea that way? Nah, I'm not going to serve the tea that way. So what happens often is then we fix in one or the other. We say, okay, I see this illusion of self, I understand that, And at some point I realize I have an experience of this other, this not self, this impersonal, this continuous, this absolute, this empty, this not form, whatever you want to call it. Limitlessness, everything is it, I say sometimes. Everything is perfect. And then, the funny thing is, the restricted, separate, individual self imposes himself there and wants to hold on to that and make that his or hers. Impossible. This is impossible. It's fixing again. And even something that we can see in, for example, in the Christian scheme, the notion that there is heaven and hell and afterlife, and that we will go and heaven is full of all of these people who have done good things, and hell is full of all these people who have done bad things. This is an example of these isolated, separate, discontinued selves being implanted in the continuous absolute, which is not possible. The undying is undying, and the dying is dying. The dying cannot undie. The form, the nature of the form is to die. It's not impermanent. But there is another aspect of being that is impermanent. But it doesn't look like this. It manifests as this now, in the world in which things die. But it is not limited to this. And this is not what is impermanent, this form. So, in a very, so I took the example of this Christian notion of heaven and hell and all that. If we look sort of in a more everyday scheme of governments, so you have democracy, which is founded by these individual selves with an attachment to self, with an attachment to this self that is really a shadow, and those the desires of that self. And what happens is then, in a democracy, which is understandable, the desires of the majority win. What pleases the majority rules. And that's not necessarily what is true or right, but it's what pleases the majority. So there's inherent in this system of democracy is this problem, is this fracture that gives rise to an attachment, which is born of and gives rise to an attachment to this self and its desires, rather than putting them aside and experiencing the impersonal and therefore acting from what is right, best, appropriate for the in-person. The opposite happens in a totalitarian system, in a dictatorship, for example, well, totalitarian, let's say. That is a denial of the individual, of the personal. That is making everything the same, no distinctions. This is an attachment to the non, the self attaching to the non-self. So, this practice basically is just seeing through the illusion of self, of this self that looks like a shadow, that is a mirage, that is red when in fact it's not. And the way that we do that is you're doing it all day, every day here. And although you probably don't realize it, that the hold of the self, of the hold of this illusionary self, it's losing its grip in very subtle ways. It's hold. It's losing its. And it's it doesn't know that, however. It can't know that. The shadow cannot know the disappearance of itself. But as, you know, I watch my cat often chase her, the shadow of her tail on the floor. And there's a certain, the light is shining in a certain way in the room, in a certain place, and she loves to go to that place in the morning when the light is shining that way, and chase her tail. She loves it. She's not chasing her tail, actually. She's chasing the shadow of it. And even if I can, when she's not looking in a certain way, then I can make shadows with my hands on the floor, and she chases those too, and I can make them go under the rug. And she tries to go under the rug, and she loves it. This is so vivid for me. This is so much what we do. Chasing the shadow. And we've all done it as children, too, trying to walk on our shadow or walk on someone else's shadow. There was a book, a famous American book, written by a journalist who had lived in South Africa, and it was about apartheid in South Africa. And the name of the book was Move Your Shadow. I can't remember why, but it had something to do with the blacks in South Africa. The whites even wanted them to move their shadows, wanted them to even move the illusion of their existence. And this is, we often do this. We want people to get out of our way, when in fact it's just shadows. So when we shine, if I change the light in the room, the shadow is no longer there. If I move the light, the shadow is no longer there, and my cat has nothing to chase. And she completely forgets about it and moves on to something else. She goes to see if there's food in her dish, or she goes and looks out the window, or she sits down and looks at me, what I'm doing. The same is true of this practice. that as soon as we have turned the light on this illusion, it's no longer there. It's been seen through. Or when we are on a road and we see this mirage of the water up ahead, when we arrive there, it's not there. So when we say to see through it, we, by shining the light on it, we expose it. It has no power anymore. The tyrant has been exposed. Its power has been removed. It doesn't mean it will go away. It comes back. But it has none of the same power. Apparently there is still some power, but it's less because you've seen through it and you know it. And so then you're quicker to shine the light again. On a Tibetan, one of these big Tibetan tankas, the wild Tibetan painting things, where they have all these, you know, there's usually some sort of wild figure there, and then all these little people and figures and things going on all around. And one of them I saw once, there was a little figure who had a spade. It's one of those flat instruments that you use when you build brick walls. You put on the brick and then put the mortar and then the brick. So he had these little walls of bricks and bricks there, and he had this instrument. And he was cowering like this, and there was this big Buddha figure pointing at him. And famously, the Buddha had said, "House builder, you have been seen through. You will build no more." And so this was the scene of the pointing and the... He still will try to build the walls, but doesn't quite have the same effect. It's been seen through. Now, it's important to note this, and this came up yesterday when I was talking to someone, this notion of being distracted and being aware, right? Or being the self and being the non-self, or being material and immaterial, these two dualities. When we see through, as I said, it doesn't mean it goes away. When we become aware, it's true, at that moment we see our distraction. We also see our awareness. If we are truly aware, we see we are aware, and we see we are distracted. We are when we are distracted. when we truly see through this illusion of self, we see no self and self, and we include both. To not include them is to exclude one or the other. So if we only include awareness, we are being distracted from distraction. We are not including it. The visual aspect we can give to this, and I have said this before, I don't know here, but of a triangle. So we have the two bases of the triangle. One would be self and no self, or distraction and awareness, or material and immaterial, or discontinuous and continuous. And to stay on one side or the other is to exclude the other. And we call this a one-legged awakening, to be standing only on one leg. It's not very stable. So on the triangle, there is the third point, which is above. Although it's not really above, but in the drawing it's above. And that includes both. That includes both sides. The two sides are joined there. Without either one of those sides, we wouldn't have this point. And seeing through the illusion implies that. Seeing through the self implies that. That's why the term letting go or abandoning can be misunderstood, because it implies, we think, it implies get rid of that side of the triangle. Let it go, get rid of it, abandon it, throw it away. But then we end up still with the problem of being stuck somewhere. Both sides are important. Both sides have their role. And in the rituals, both sides are embodied. Through the very concrete forms, do you know now? Embodied?
Is it embodied?
Embodied. Both aspects are embodied. And when we have problems with rituals, usually we have problems because we are trying to understand them, make sense of them, make them coherent, make them understandable, believable, make them fit the rules of the intellect. And they don't. And so then we're really uncomfortable with it. We don't like it. It doesn't make sense. It's stupid. What am I doing? I'm losing control if I do that. I'm giving my power up if I bow. Many different possibilities of how we interpret that. It's a fear of the unknown. It's a fear of the continuous. It's a fear of putting down our rational mind and opening to the irrational. Yet in a very concrete way. Now, I say that for ritual in this context, but it's true for any ritual anywhere. All rituals in all religious traditions have that same role. All the way back to sort of ancient rituals in which there were sacrifices, human sacrifices or animal sacrifices. Through those rituals, the individuals experience the unity. They experience this other aspect of reality. And when I use the word religion, religious in the sense of not in an organizational way, but as in a the way I would define religious is an inner experience. as opposed to an outer experience. And then an experience of this other aspect. And what happens often is then these individual selves become attached to the ritual. And the ritual loses its role, it loses its meaning, it loses its function. There are some Zen traditions where people spend more time putting on their robes and telling people how to do different roles and actions than they do sitting and looking at the self. That is, putting on the robes and insisting that these things be done in a certain way. And there are others that put no emphasis on forms, on rituals, have none. What is the, how do you find what the Buddha called the middle way between the two extremes? So, is there anything else I want? Yeah, I actually didn't have to look at any of these notes, but I guess it made me feel like I know something. So how to, when I say how to know what is the middle way, there is no way to know it. It can only be experienced. We can practice. We can learn the rituals. We can learn the chants. We can learn how to eat in a formal way. We can put on the robes, learn how they should be put on, all of these things. But finding that middle way, finding that non-attachment, not being fixed in one or the other, has to be experienced. And concrete ways in which we experience this in our everyday life are, there are so many you can't even count them. It's every moment. Our very existence is the manifestation of that. It's a balance between life and death. Our body is full of cancerous cells. I'm not a doctor. Yvonne would know more about this than me, but or a scientist. But apparently there are cancerous cells, and sometimes they take over, and then there is our body is sick, and sometimes they don't. There's some sort of balance that is worked out. We could maybe even say that when the cancerous cells take over, that it's not necessarily bad. That's just what's happening, in one sense. In a more sort of less, in a less ethereal or abstract way, an example that I cite all the time, which is becoming more distant, but in the final of the Champions League soccer, I can't remember what year it was. If there are football fans, they might know. But it was Real Madrid against, I think, Bremen or Leverkusen, a German team. And Zinedine Zidane was playing for Real Madrid. And if anyone saw that match, did anyone here see that match? No. Zinedine Zidane scored a goal that was the absolute manifestation of what I'm talking about. There was no self. He was absolutely embodying what we call no mind. The ball came to him. We see football players do this a lot, but sometimes it's right and sometimes it's not. The ball came to him, and he volleyed it with his left foot into the goal. We say this is, I think he even turned, actually. There was a pivot involved. We see these kinds of goals. It's not uncommon, necessarily. It's unusual, and when we see it, we think, "Ah, that's really an amazing goal." But this one in particular, and Zidane had this quality at times when he was playing, it was almost mesmerizing. It was as if he was not moving. He was moving without moving, and no one could stop him. Not all the time, but certain moments, and that's why he was a great football player. And other great football players are great for that same reason. Someone else who does it now is Lionel Messi, who plays for Barcelona. Same thing. He has the same sort of, he doesn't look like Zidane, but he has the same sort of moving without moving quality that no one can stop. So when Zidane scored this goal, everything that he had ever done in his life, everything that had ever, every ball he had ever kicked, every technique he had ever learned, every practice, every time he had received the ball, every time he had looked at a football game, everything he had ever done came together in that moment with absolute perfection. And he had this capacity. He even ended his career with one of those moments. However, it was not a moment that we would think of as positive, we would think of it as negative, right? But it also was a moment like that. He had this quality, Zidane, of being perfectly in the moment so that whatever happened in that moment was right. He always would score the winning goal. Sometimes he didn't, but sometimes when there was a winning goal, he scored it. In this game, he did. I'm going into this example of Zidane because everyone's heard of Zidane. You know, even if you don't really know, if you never saw him play, you heard about him. Probably everyone has seen, even if they weren't watching, has seen how he ended his career with the head to the Materazzi in the final of the World Cup. I'm saying it because it's a very concrete, real example. In your own life, you can think of examples like that. Another example I use is when I learned to play tennis as a child. And first they show you how to hold the racket, and then they show you how to swing, and then you have to do this, and you do part of the swing, and then you do the whole swing, and then you learn how to throw the ball, and you learn how to serve, and you have to practice throwing the ball up like this, and then swinging and half a serve, and endless technique that you learn. And as a child, you just want to go out there and hit the ball. And they show you how to move your feet, and you have to do these drills where you practice how to move your feet and how to turn. And then in my day, we still were learning the one-handed backhand, so you turn the way the grip and stroke a certain way. And then the moment comes when you go out there and you hit the ball across the net. And in that moment, you no longer are dealing with, is your foot in the right place? Is your racket in the right place? Are you swinging correctly? Are you holding it correctly? Where are you hitting the ball? At what moment? And then the teacher will come and say, no, 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 no. You have to have your elbow up, or you have to bend your right knee, or whatever it is. And then you do it, you correct it. And at some point, then it just becomes like driving a car. Same thing. Driving a car, if you were constantly thinking of every single thing you were supposed to pay attention to when you were driving a car, you would never go anywhere. Or you would hit the first thing that you can get up to. Same thing. So we practice sitting here. We practice letting things come up. We have a technique, counting the breath, or sitting with a question, or looking through the self, whatever it is, whatever your chosen option is. And then we stand up and we go into life. And that's what the point is. And at some moment, which we think of as being magic, the Zidan moment, it all comes together. The fact is, however, that our, as I said with democracy, our society is based upon individual selves attached to themselves. And so everything is constructed in a way to divert our attention from the Zidan moment, from the potential we have for the Zidan moment, for the awareness of it, even. The awareness that is required to experience it, but also the awareness of when we are experiencing it. So we have it's not an easy path. It's not easy, and it's like it's marginal, this path. It's the middle way, but it's marginal. Because, like in the art world, we have what we call avant-garde. And the avant-garde is always on the edge. It has to be. Its very nature is to be on the edge. Because otherwise, it would fall into the trap of what pleases the majority, which is not necessarily what's true and right, as I said. It doesn't mean that what pleases the majority is not true and right. That's not the point. It may well be. I'm not saying true and right in the sense of wrong in this dualistic way. with the Zidan moment, he let go of any sort of thought, any sort of rational. He wasn't basing the calculation of how he struck the ball with his foot according to some sort of law of physics, and positioning himself exactly at that spot on the grass so that it would have this precise angle and would go at such a speed that it would go faster than the goalkeeper could get his hand to it. No. Boom. It was direct. Because everything had brought him to that moment, that space. And it's the same sitting here in a cushion. Exactly the same. This is the final of the Champions League. Every moment you're sitting here. Or the World Cup, let's say. This is the final of the World Cup. And it's interesting that, just because we're talking about football, a nation like Brazil that produces so many unbelievable football players and has a sense of football that no one else has. You know, other nations have a different feel for it, but the Brazilian football is something special. And there are, it seems that there is an endless pool of beautiful football players in Brazil. Why? Why should one nation, why should it be like that? There are all sorts of explanations, who knows? But one explanation is that Brazilians put a lot of emphasis on football. And they enjoy it. And everybody plays it. Everywhere. I've never been to Brazil, but you would know. Everybody plays it. Everywhere. And so because so much energy is put into that, and so much attention is put into it, and so much value is put on it, of course there's excellence. It's a very natural action and result. Another example is Tibet, which has very few football players, probably, but has an unbelievable amount of highly realized spiritual people. According to the size and the population of that nation, there is a phenomenal heightened spirituality and realization. Again, same thing. The entire culture, the entire nation is attentive to that. Something like, I think it's 25% of the population of Tibet lives in monasteries. And then another 25% lives near and is in direct contact daily with a monastery. So it's not surprising that if that is what the society values, that is what the result will be. The same thing is true of each of us. If you practice swimming, if you swim every day, you will be able to swim better than someone who doesn't, or longer, or quicker, or more skillfully, I don't know. Same thing. If we devote our time to sitting here, minute after minute, hour after hour, day after day, something results that would not result if we had not done it. So we like to say in this practice that Zidan moment is an accident. A total accident. We can't make it happen. Zidan could not say, at the 73rd minute of the final of the, I think it was 2006 Champions League, I will score this goal this way. No. Total accident. But we can cultivate the ground so that accidents will happen. Zidane cultivated the ground so that that accident could happen. And this sitting, this practice that we do, is cultivating the ground so that the accidents can happen. So that exact situation of light and shadow that produces this illusion of self will dissipate and we will see through it. So the the rituals and the forms here are part of that cultivating ground for the accent. It puts in place something that we will bump into so that the accident will happen. Or it puts in place something that when I put on my robe, I take off my other clothing and put on something else that can be seen as impersonal, which doesn't make me realize that, but it can help me realize that. I don't have to do that. I can also put on these clothes and experience that. It's not dependent on the piece of clothing, and it's not dependent on the statue on the altar or on the bowing. But those are special circumstances that help cultivate the accidents. The accident, because the experience of this no-self, this incoherence, this irrationality, cannot be anything other than accidental. Its very nature is accidental, in the sense that it's not organized like this aspect is. And to expect it to be otherwise is to not see its nature, to not see what it is. But we don't know that until we experience it. We can't know it until we experience it. We can hear people talk about it. I can sit here and point out all of these examples and try to find, you know, something that speaks to us, which is worthy. That's reasonable. It's not a bad thing. But hearing, you know, I told you all about Zidane's goal. You didn't see it. So already you're one step removed from it. And me telling you about it doesn't make you experience it. And I wasn't in the stadium. I was watching it on television. So I didn't experience it in the way that people present did. And the people in the stadium weren't on the field. So they didn't experience it the way the men on the field did. And the other players on Zidane's team didn't experience it like he did. And the players on the other team didn't experience it like he did. Or like players on the other team experienced it. It's always one step removed, unless we experience it ourselves. But it can be helpful to hear about it. And the, just reminded me, the Zidane head incident in the final of the 2006 World Cup, I was working as a journalist that night at my office and watching it on television. And there was a reporter from my newspaper at the stadium. And when it happened, millions and millions of people around the world saw it, watching it on television. But in the stadium, a lot of people didn't see it because they weren't watching. It was not where the ball was. It was at a different part of the field. And the reporter who was sitting there called the newspaper to find out what was going on. He was in the stadium in Berlin, and we were in Paris at the newspaper, and he didn't see it. He didn't know what was going on, and the referees were consulting, and they were showing Zidane a red card, and nobody knew what was going on. So his experience of it was very different from my experience of it. And so what's really ironic is that, you know, millions and millions, a huge number of, one of the biggest television audiences ever on the planet saw that happen. And the 75 or 80,000 people in the stadium who had, you know, years in advance arranged to have this ticket and paid huge sums of money and were there, and they weren't there because they weren't looking at it. They were looking somewhere else. This is the story of our life. The reporter was so angry. He was shouting at me on the telephone. So angry. It was not my fault, but he was so upset. And this is the story of our life. We're looking somewhere else. And we don't see what's happening. So.
Yes, but at the same time, we don't have to see everything. We're seeing other things.
Yeah, he had a different experience. That's true. That's true. Absolutely different experience. And we can say this comes back to the question of democracy. Who's to say that the experience that what everyone, the majority, saw was what was what should be seen? Who's to say? That's true. Absolutely. And to fix in one or the other is to miss the whole. To say that, I think it's really interesting what the reporter experienced, to be in that stadium at that moment and not see what all the commotion was about. I think that was really interesting. And I think he did after the fact too. He was also very angry because it was late and the game was in overtime and we had a deadline for the newspaper and he didn't have time to write the story and he didn't know what the story was supposed to say, and he was very angry. But I think after the fact he realized that it was quite interesting what he had experienced. I think he even wrote something about that. So it's again, immediately the mind goes, okay, well, I was seeing something else, so I was not wrong. That was not right. So immediately we go into this duality. And that's to miss the point again. It's, the point is to include both. To not be stuck in one or the other. And I also after that incident, a few days later, I was in a retreat, I think, a few days after that Zidan head incident. And I gave my talk on that. And basically it was that just before that, I don't know if anyone was watching that, A few minutes before that, Zidan headed a ball towards the goal. And, you know, like just with the tip of his finger, the Italian goalkeeper stopped it. It was a phenomenal save. And I think the entire French nation was sure that that ball was going in. And Zidane was about to become a god. He already was a god because he had scored twice with his head to win the World Cup. And here he was going to score again with his head to win the World Cup again. Probably the entire French nation, but also a lot of people watching the television thought that goal was going in. And Zidane himself, I'm convinced, thought it was going in. And it didn't. Suddenly, everything changed. And I think it was only like 3 or 4 minutes later when, with his head, he knocks over a player. it's as if he suddenly this no mind, because it didn't function according to his habitual way of experiencing it, the ball didn't go in, something else happened, he was thrown into a state of total disarray, total incoherence, chaos. Nothing had any of the usual pattern. Usually when Zenon does something like that, he scores, he wins, that's it, he's the hero. It didn't happen that way. The rug was pulled out from under him. And then his action, I said, it was another Zidane moment. It was an action that was in perfect harmony with the chaos of the moment that he was experiencing. It was total chaos. It was totally irrational. He later tried to explain it and say, well, he didn't actually, but, you know, there were excuses. He insulted my mother. He was pulling on my shirt. He also insulted my sister. You know, this kind of stuff. It was transcendent. In that moment, it was total chaos, and he reacted totally one with the chaos. Boom. And then he was gone. And, you know, there's also ways of looking at it from a psychological point of view of I don't know in the rest of the world, but in France, Zidane is sort of a god, and he is trapped by that status. And in a way, this going out with a head and a red card was a way of refusing that. I'm not a god. I'm a man. I'm like everybody else. And the fact that the goal wasn't scored was confirmation of that. Total oneness with the moment. So this is just an example of being one with the moment, not being attached to one or the other, being in the middle way, being in the Zidane moment, will not look like we think it will look. It doesn't always mean scoring the goal and winning the game. It's not it. When we are inside, when it is an inner experience of the moment as it is, then there's no doubt. And it's neither good nor bad. And the rituals and the forms give us access to that experience of this continuous unity, the impersonal. Sometimes we say the true self, but not true as opposed to the false. The true self, in fact, when we say the true self, that means both of these aspects together. So this would be the true self, which includes both. Okay, any questions?
Maybe it's not really a question, more a sharing something, but also maybe a question about the ritual. For me, I think the rituals they are challenging because I always think a lot before, will I do it the right way? Will I do it wrong? Will it be okay? Will it not be okay? Will it be in time? I judge a lot, and when I arrived here and I sang for the first time at night, and I spent almost half an hour thinking, how will I sing? Should I remember the words? Should my voice come out? And then at some point I said, I'm just going to stop now with all these judgments and questions and worries, and I'll see. And then I just sang, and I remember I even enjoyed singing. So for me, it is challenging because it's gives me the opportunity to trust more that I will do it as the way it has to be. And that night I think I dropped it, the idea of what is good singing or bad singing. I just, at some point I really had to do it. Okay, I'm not going to think about it anymore, I'll just sing and that's it. And so I sang, and it was really...
It was really what?
I was more relieved when when you stop judging and worrying. Yeah. And so I think it allows me to have more trust in me that I will have the... I will do what I need at that time. And
exactly.
And I see that I can exercise it in rituals, and maybe little by little I can also bring it for what I have to what I have to do in other occasions. Trust more that I will do it. Independently of what I think it's good, bad, right, or wrong, and if it will be in time, if it will be correct or incorrect, I can maybe little by little I can start drop a little all these worries and judges, and so for me it's kind of a challenge thing for you.
It's a good example. A very good example. And actually what it's a good example of letting go of the personal, my opinions of what I will sound like, what I will sound like, if I am doing it good or not, what will they think of me, will my voice be good or bad, whatever. And accepting to let go of that and just doing it. And then when you just do it, then you experience the impersonal aspect of it. It's just, and you say it's sort of a relief or something, but you're no longer attached to those, to that self that is getting in the way. And if you are trying to do it good, and you are trying, it's usually when it doesn't sound very good. You know, it sounds sort of off, or you make a mistake, or because you're, something's in the way, and that something is, like you say, all the things you think about it. Yeah, good example. And everyone, I'm sure you all can find examples like that in your life. Not only here, but everywhere, in everything you do. And, as Claudia said, then you gain trust. You gain, okay. You maybe still go through the same process of doubting and thinking, oh, I have to do this again, I have to sing again, does it look okay, does it sound okay, but you trust that it will be okay. And that's where your right action is, that's where the middle way is, right there.
Uh, what my God is seeing. There was this time that I was filming something with my girlfriend, something funny, and in the end she wanted to see how it was. It's pretty common, you know, oh, how was this look? And I was talking and the sound, hearing my voice in the video, was completely different than what I'm hearing now. And I knew that it was common for the human being not to hear his voice how it really is. But when I heard the video, I said, my voice is so stupid, I will never talk again. And I didn't talk till like midnight or something. I was silent. I wouldn't talk with anybody because I think this is so stupid. I can never talk again. And then I would think, there was sometimes I would sing and people would say, oh, you sing very well. They were lying. It's so stupid. And then I went to bed. And then when I woke up, I forgot about it, and I stopped talking again. And then I remember, oops, what am I doing? And then it was like, it happened to Claudia, and I'm going to never talk again. What idea?
People
stupid. So stupid. And it happens to everybody.
Absolutely. Same thing, yeah. Absolutely. And it's useful to talk.
Yes.
And that's how you communicate, yeah.
Yes. Yes.
A good example of, because I want to appear a certain way, I will cut myself off from others. I will make myself separate so that I will appear how I want to appear.
Yes.
Or something.
And when I'm here in the retreat, sometimes I don't even talk to people, but I bow and nod my head. Probably I could do most of the things that I do normally and find a way to not talk. But I would lose the way that I usually do. But because I was in that idea that it wouldn't sound as I thought that it would usually do, I would stop doing what I usually do.
That's right.
And I would do something different.
That's right. And if you didn't talk, none of us would have heard this story.
Also has a question. Well, it would be more a kind of a comment I would like to have. Because in this poem, which is from Onji, they say, I never know the names because they change. But there is here, in this guy post or silent illumination, there is what I 4 or 6 statements, which I consider, it seems to me a kind of a red alert for practitioners. And this concluded me, so that's what I would like to offer a comment. When he says, but, by learning and certifying that respond appropriately, but, If illumination neglects serenity, then elusiveness appears, which I can guess that as a more sanctifying and dialoguing they respond to each other appropriately. But if serenity neglects illumination, murkiness leads to wasted dharma. And that's what's why it makes more confusing to me.
If serenity...
Why such, it seems to be a red alert for silent illumination and the silence illumination, the balance, but if you have the illumination but neglect the serenity, well, okay, I understand that you can start hitting people, but if you have the serenity and neglect illumination, murkiness leads to wasted dharma.
Murkiness?
Murkiness.
Yeah.
Murkiness, which is...
Right. Murkiness leads to...
It is from there to that side.
It means not clear. It means muddiness.
Not something.
Okay. So, right.
The middle one.
Right, it begins by saying dialoguing and certifying, they respond appropriate to each other.
So
that's the equivalent of having the top of the triangle.
Yeah.
If illumination, meaning to, right, awakening, to see things as they are, neglects serenity, which means, I'm not sure how they're using the word serenity, but if it is not serene, meaning if it is not, it doesn't include, I think would be, then aggressiveness appears. Then there can be conflicts, right? If they dialogue and certify one another, if they include both, then they respond appropriately. If serenity, I guess what they're meaning by serenity would mean the opposite of illumination, say.
If the calming side,
right.
Yes, isn't
that? That's it, yeah.
Calming,
just
calming.
Right.
If it's calming, too much, it's my interpretation.
Right.
If it's too much calming, something wrong.
Exactly,
happen.
Exactly. The calming, meaning calm, no. Serenity in the sense of almost a deadness, almost a not moving, like water that is stagnant. If it neglects illumination, then the muddiness, like water becomes muddy if it's stagnant, then that leads to wasted dharma. What they mean by wasted dharma is, we could say, missed opportunity in that sense. You know? It's the life is wasted. The life of the moment is wasted if we just sit in a dull way, as opposed to crossing the room with that spoonful of hot water, of hot oil. But then it ends with, when silent illumination is fulfilled, the lotus blossoms, the dreamer awaken. 100 streams flow into the ocean, 1,000 ranges face the highest peak. So everything is fulfilled when there is this, I see, they're using the silent and illumination together. So that is the equivalent of the calmness, the serenity, with the awakening, with the illumination. When the two are married, or when the two include one another, then it's the Zidan moment. Exactly, that's the lotus blossoms, the dream and awakenings, the whole thing. And that's the important aspect of this is the dialoguing and certifying. The not being cut off.
Certifying, what do you mean that?
Yeah, certifying.
With a kind of confirmation.
Exactly, they confirm one another. Yeah, they affirm one another. So it's like light and dark. Light does not take away the darkness, and the darkness does not take away the light, but you can't have one without the other. There is no darkness without light, and there is no light without darkness. They are codependent. And so they are certifying, they're dialoguing. They dialogue all the time. They have a direct dialogue, you could say, sort of right about sunset, right about sunrise, I don't know, you know. But is the time up?
Yes.
We're very late? Okay. So, time to go. But this is a different approach to it, but it's saying the same thing.